some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency.
I've now been in 57 states.
From the heartland of America, this is PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert. Sharon will be along shortly as we dip into the archives once again tonight. This weekend marks the 40th anniversary of a watershed event in American history. It was 40 years ago that the world was shocked to learn of the brutal murders connected to Charles Manson and his family. And as author and researcher Peter Lavenda dug into Manson's past, he found some very disturbing connections to elements, very prominent and powerful elements within American society and government. And so back in the spring of 2005, we interviewed Peter about his three-volume work, Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft, a set that we jokingly referred to as the Six Degrees of Charles Manson. The interview has been offline for a couple of years, and we've never presented it in full in one shot before. So now as we look back 40 years at Charles Manson and the connections to sinister forces within our society, we present this archived interview with Peter Lavenda on PID Radio.
Peter, thank you for being our guest on PID Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's a fascinating work, and Sharon and I are still, you know, working through the two books that have been published so far, Book 1, The Nine, and Book 2, A Warm Gun. But the scope of your work, you know, unlike most people who tackle the influence of the occult, I mean, to go from everything from the mounds, the Indian burial mounds in the United States, mm-hmm. through UFOs and onto the Kennedy assassination and Charles Manson, and it's daunting.
It reminds me of the whiteboard we have right now that has all of these different threads on there. And if you just looked at one, you'd think this can't possibly be connected to this other. But, you know, when you take a look at it, in fact, you mentioned in your book how you found out that you were just two handshakes away, as you put it, from Charles Manson. And that's how a lot of these topics seem to be. They do interconnect.
Well, that's what I came to understand. I think what sparked my interest in all of this was Watergate. In 1975, Watergate was happening, and I started to see a lot of very familiar names and faces popping up in the Watergate investigations, people who had been involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion, for instance, in Cuba, names that have been associated with the Kennedy assassination. And I started to look at this and think, my goodness, there's a thread that's continuing back to, well, I was 13 years old when Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember those moments, of course, quite vividly, and then seeing some of the same figures show up 12 years later during the Watergate investigations, I started to see that there were connections, and I didn't understand the connections, really, until there was a chance article written in the Village Voice around that time called Political Witchcraft, or perhaps it was called Patriotic Witchcraft. I can't quite remember the title, but it was something along those lines. And in one breath, the author mentioned Charles Manson and Richard Nixon, and started juxtaposing all of these things. And I began to become fascinated with the idea that there was something darker at work in American history that could be traced through coincidence and synchronicity, which is kind of a popular New Age term they're throwing around these days, but which has a very august pedigree back to the days of Wolfgang Pauli, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and his, mm-hmm. his correspondence with Carl Jung, the psychiatrist. I mean, there's something deeper at work, and it's possibly through all of these coincidental links that we can see vaguely the shape of something darker underneath the fabric of American history. So it became kind of an obsession to me to try to pull it at some of these threads. In a way, things were made easier because of my own background and my own involvement. I was very interested in religion as a teenager in the 60s, which was not that uncommon. A lot of people became involved with Eastern religions, for instance, or mm-hmm. or the sort of New Age paganism and that sort of thing. But I became paradoxically more interested in conservative Orthodox religions, such as the Eastern Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church and how it operated. And in those days, I found myself talking to people who I later found out were peripherally involved in the investigation into the Kennedy assassination. And I didn't realize that until almost the 1980s. And then everything started to fall into place for me at that time.
So you chose to start the book with an examination of the Indian burial mounds. Do you find that there is some connection or thread that goes back that far? I mean, it predates the arrival of what we're told anyway, is the arrival of white men on the continent.
Well, yeah, I did. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't expecting anything concerning the Indian burial mounds until I went to visit Ashland, Kentucky. Ashland, Kentucky is where Charles Manson grew up. Some sources state that he was born there. Actually, his birth records say he was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is possible. His mother was unmarried at the time, and possibly she wanted to have her child outside of town. But he was brought up in Ashland, and I decided to visit Ashland, Kentucky for myself to see, you know, what was going on. Because just across the river from Ashland, a famous serial killer had been born and raised, Bobby Joe Long. And Henry Lee Lucas had been born down at the border of West Virginia and Virginia. So I was starting to wonder if there was, you know, something to the water or something that was raising this crop of really spectacular killers. So I went to Ashland, Kentucky, and the first thing I noticed was right in the center of town there was this string of burial mounds, Indian burial mounds that no one in the town seems to really know anything about. I mean, there's not really a lot of information about it, not even at the museum in the town. What artifacts were found there, no one seems to know. There's a lot of controversy as to when they were built. But it seems as though they were built by the Adena culture, which is an ancient Indian or Native American culture that goes back to about 800 B.C. At the earliest. So we're talking about a very old culture. And I started to research the burial mounds, trying to figure out, you know, what possible relationship this could have to Charles Manson or to the darkness I was beginning to feel was at the heart of the American experience. And that led me into an investigation of American prehistory. And what I discovered there was astonishing because, again, I had not expected this, but I found that archaeologists have been finding over the last 100 or 150 years, numerous artifacts that would tend to indicate that America had been visited long before Columbus by people from Europe or North Africa, bringing with them their religions and their religious ideas. They found the Ten Commandments written in an ancient form of Hebrew, written on a stone that was buried in one of the burial mounds in the United States. They found all sorts of prayers, incantations from different types of cults buried there. They found traditions among the Native Americans concerning tribes composed of blonde-haired, blue-eyed people. Even some of the early European explorers claimed they came upon a tribe that spoke Welsh, of all things.
Yeah, the Medoc stories.
Right? This is fascinating, and I'm thinking to myself, well, this is a part of American history, isn't it? Why are we ignoring it? Mm-hmm. Why do we start arbitrarily American history in 1492? With the discovery by Columbus. There is something, obviously, that goes on much earlier. And to understand America, I think we have to understand that. Who really lived in our cities before our cities were built? You know, we've built prisons. We've built military complexes on top of these burial mound sites. We've built towns occasionally on top of these sites. They're there like America's Stonehenge, basically, huge earthworks. All over the United States, as far as the Mississippi River.
Oh, yeah, one's not far from us. Cahokia is about,
Cahokia is a famous burial mound.
Sure, yeah, it's only about 40 miles from here, yeah.
Well, there you go, the Serpent Mound. I mean, all of these things are Chillicothe. The burial mounds at Chillicothe, mm-hmm. Ohio, are very famous. And we're ignoring them. These mounds, in some cases, are as ancient as the pyramids in Egypt or Stonehenge in England. They point to the existence of a religion and a way of looking at the world that we have no records of. And yet, from my way of thinking, when Europeans came here, it was like they were entering a kind of a haunted house. As I talk about in the third volume, which hasn't come out yet, but I look at America as a haunted house, as a place that has been built layer upon layer over other civilizations, and at times on the blood of innocent people. And I think that we have to confront this, though, as we've tried to confront it with our history of slavery. I think we have to go back even further now and try to look at well, what does it mean really to be an American per se? Who are we really, and what kind of karmic debt have we incurred by living in this country and exploiting it as we have? So the burial mound culture became very important for me, so I do spend a lot of time on that. Writers have sensed a kind of mystical origin to America, writers like H.P. Lovecraft that I mention in Sinister Forces, because he wrote about pagan rites, you know, being conducted in the mountains of Massachusetts or Rhode Island. And he could not have known at that time that the evidence would later turn up that there were indeed such cults living in New England, you know, operating in New England before the coming of the of Columbus and his and the British and Dutch explorers after him. So there was a kind of sense among some of our best writers and poets and artists that there was something else taking place in our woods, in our towns, in our villages in this country. There was another darker kind of root to it. It may not have meant anything, except that we started to put our prisons, inexplicably, on the sites where these burial mounds were found. We have the case of Moundsville in West Virginia. We have Chillicothe in Ohio. We have prisons built right across the street, or at times right on top of Indian burial mounds. And I began to wonder, in other cultures, if you were to do that, you were, in, you know, you were asking for the wrath of the gods, you know, mm-hmm. by disturbing sacred sites like that. And I wondered at our intention of putting prisons, for some reason, on burial mound sites. And in these same prisons, we found people who were being incarcerated, such as Henry Lee Lucas, a famous murderer. Who spent a lot of time in Chillicothe, as did, I believe, Manson at some point. One of Manson's family members spent a lot of time in Moundsville, West Virginia, in that prison, on and on. I was starting to see a connection that was a little disturbing. One of our most famous locations in the United States is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where mm-hmm. a lot of people believe that the Roswell crash artifacts were taken.
Right.
And that's built on an Indian burial mound site. So it became fascinating to me. Do we have to revisit American history? We have to, I think, honor these civilizations that were here before, at least to the extent that we investigate them and we incorporate them into our history books as much as possible.
Well, you know, the name of our show, of course, is PID, which stands for Peering into Darkness. And,
yes.
And the way Derek and I see things is that there indeed are sinister forces behind many of the things, even politically, that take place in our country and all across the world. And, of course, we see it from a supernatural point of view. We look at it from a biblical standpoint and
sure.
consider the dark forces that are described in the Old Testament and partly in the New Testament as well. And it's clear that, you know, you and I and Derek, that we may not totally agree on the interpretation, but clearly there is something there.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, that's, you become more and more convinced of it the more and more you become involved in the research, not just because of the intellectual information that you get, but also because of the things that begin to happen around you as you begin to study this material.
Really?
You begin to see the coincidences and the strange things pile up around you, things that are,
now, are you
kind of inexplicable.
Are you speaking from some sort of personal experience with
Oh, sure.
sinister
Absolutely.
Forces? Can you reveal
Absolutely.
Any of that?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, just in general, as I was beginning the research for the book, I found that information that I needed would just suddenly appear. I mean, I did a lot of the research in the final stages of writing the book in a foreign country. I was in Malaysia. I was living there for years in a Muslim country. And I would find that very obscure monographs and academic and scholarly texts long out of print that I needed for my research would show up in bizarre little secondhand bookstores in strange little towns in the rainforest. I mean, bizarre things would continually happen.
Did the bookstore disappear when you walked out?
No.
and the Asian proprietor just laughed.
No, nothing quite that bizarre. But you have to appreciate how strange it is to be living in a foreign country that remote and that uh-huh. removed from the academic community here. And to come across information that you needed, even books that were privately published by some important people that I had been researching, you know, privately printed monographs would be stuck in bookshelves. I mean, it was just insane. It was bizarre. So you found yourself basically having your hand guided into areas of research. Important information would come to you that you would have no way of knowing even existed. And that was an important thing. Everybody who gets involved in this, I think, at a certain point begins to value the appearance of this coincidence or synchronicity patterns, what I call the coincidence stream, that sort of carries you along and makes your life a little easier when it comes to the research, and at the same time turns your hair white as you as you continue the research and see what it's all about. So when it comes to sinister forces, to me, these sinister forces do exist. Of course, they're referred to biblically. They're referred to in other cultures as well. Everyone seems to realize that in the supernatural world, there is conflict. And whether there's conflict between light and darkness, good and evil, however you want to describe it, the conflict exists, and sides are taken. And you can look at it in a purely Christian context and talk about the angelic forces versus demonic ones. And you can easily use that as the paradigm for understanding the sinister forces in the United States. There does seem to be a struggle between two moral entities, and it infuses our political life. It has to. I think there is no real separation between church and state in the United States. We've enshrined it in our Constitution, but I don't think that it actually takes place in reality. I mean, who can really split themselves in half that way? Our politicians can't, and I think that many of our politicians harbor sometimes bizarre ideological beliefs and bizarre religious beliefs that they don't talk about, but which certainly inform their actions as they go along. I mean, we have secret societies involved in our country to the extent that it worries me, and I may sound stupid or paranoid for even mentioning it, but you know, we have a secret society, for instance, at Yale University that everyone's heard of by now, I guess, Skull and Bones.
Oh, yeah, we talk about that stuff on this show all the time. Feel free, go right.
Well, 15 people a year, only 15 people a year are initiated into Skull and Bones. So that's a very small percentage of the human population, a very small percentage of the American population for sure. We're talking about 0.0001% of the population gets initiated into is currently a member of Skull and Bones. There are fewer than there's got to be fewer than 1,000 members alive today, and yet we have so many of them in the administration. How does that happen? You know, it strains credulity to think that this was just quote unquote a coincidence.
Right.
You know, that John Kerry and George Bush would both have been members of Skull and Bones.
And frankly, if you take a look at Skull and Bones and see how it's connected to Germanic occult influences and frankly how that links into Hitler.
Well, you've gotten right back into my neck of the woods there. I mean, my first book, of course, was on Holy Alliance, and that was an investigation of Nazi occultism. That book deals really in depth with the growth of the Nazi Party as really an outgrowth or a splinter sect of a Nazi occult society in Munich that was created right after World War I. And I trace the occult beliefs of the Nazi Party through the SS in particular, through Himmler's SS, and right down to the present day. Really, Sinister Forces is a continuation of my study of German occultism, because I began to realize that we imported a lot of these people after World War II into the United States, and especially into our space program, but into other areas of our lives as well. And that, to me, was a grossly immoral thing to do, a very dangerous thing to do. But then, as you mentioned, you know, Skull and Bones having links back to German secret societies, you know, without belaboring a point too much, you know, we have the Bush family really in bed with the Nazis since the 1920s.
Oh, very much so.
I mean, they were even their operations were closed down for a while by the U.S. government under the Trading with the Enemy Act. They were supporting things like eugenics, which is really a kind of scientifically masked racism and anti-Semitism. So with all of that, I mean, you can see there's a kind of consistency in the approach of a certain branch of the Republican Party, and I don't want to go after the entire Republican Party, of course, but there is a kind of movement within the party that really is not the Republican Party of Eisenhower, for instance, who warned us about it, actually.
Right.
And who warned us about the growth of the military-industrial complex.
Yes, we have military-industrial complex, yeah.
Well, he said it was a spiritual, that we were facing a spiritual crisis in America, and he was quite right, I think. I don't think we've had a Republican really like Eisenhower since then. It's kind of funny to talk about that because Eisenhower, when I was growing up, was kind of a joke of a president. We always saw him playing golf for some reason.
Yeah.
And we never really took him seriously. But that last speech that he made as he was leaving the presidency was a real warning to the United States, one that we have not heeded, I think, and we're reaping the whirlwind now from my point of view.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you also connect up to MK Ultra, and you talk about the movie Manchurian Candidate,
right.
as actually being something as probably telling the truth about activities that were taking place in our government at the time. And then you connect that up to Charles Manson. So can you kind of follow that thread for us?
Sure. Hold on to your hats, though. You know, the thread that connects is a very dark one, and to me, it's at the heart of my whole study. It's really at the heart of sinister forces. Manson today, as some of your listeners, I'm sure, realize, has pronounced a lot of pro-Nazi sentiments. Some neo-Nazi parties in the United States have adopted him as kind of their spiritual leader. And as you may recall, of course, he did carve a swastika into his forehead.
Right.
I guess you can't really get much more, you know, much more of a Nazi sympathizer than that, I suppose. So I was interested in Manson for a lot of reasons. One, because I saw him as a symbol, maybe, of what was going wrong in America. And I wanted to go back further and find out really where did Manson get his training, quote-unquote? Was Manson simply just a jailbird, an ex-convict who was crazy or strung out on drugs the way he's been portrayed? Or was there something deeper at work with Charlie? So I started to do a lot of research on that, and it led me to an American intelligence operation that goes back to 1950, which in those days was called Operation or Project Bluebird. Mm-hmm. And which went through several different incarnations and eventually became MK Ultra, which may be familiar to some of you from the movie Conspiracy Theory that starred Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts.
One of my favorite movies, actually.
Yeah,
yeah, it's done very well, and it's one of the few movies where you hear MK Ultra actually being mentioned in a film. And MK Ultra was a very serious project, and it amazed me at the extent of what they were trying to do. I have over 10,000 MK Ultra and other CIA documents that had been declassified in the last 10 years or so, and I've been going over them a lot, and you would be really amazed at what this was all about. When you think of the movie The Manchurian Candidate, for instance, you're looking at what seems to be a fantasy of a person, an American, who has been brainwashed into becoming an assassin for the communists to kill a political leader, a man running for presidency. And I think that basically we had that in this country, at least in 1968, with Sirhan Sirhan. And in 1968, of course, we also had the rise of the Manson family. All of this was taking place at the same time. And all of these individuals, Manson, Sirhan Sirhan, and many others, had backgrounds in occultism, had occult training of some kind. Sirhan had belonged to Sirhan Sirhan, by the way, for those of you who are not as old as I am, was the individual who was charged with killing Senator Robert Kennedy in 68 in California.
But there's a whole controversy behind that, of course. Again,
sure.
If you're not as old as I am either, you don't know that he clearly couldn't have fired the shot that killed Kennedy. He was not
clearly could not have, not based on the evidence. Such evidence as still exists, since the Los Angeles Police Department destroyed most of it. But the evidence that does exist, plus eyewitness accounts, make it virtually impossible for Sirhan to have done it. And yet he did admit to doing it, although he claims that he has no memory of it and doesn't remember doing it, but he's perfectly willing to admit that he did it.
Mm-hmm.
These, to me, were the hallmarks of someone who had gone through a period of programming by one of our intelligence agencies.
Right.
And Manson seems to have perfected the same type of technique. Manson spent a lot of time in prison. Most of his life was spent in prison. But just before he was released in the late 1960s, he had gone through a period of training by a number of people, a number of individuals in prison up at Terminal Island. And one of the individuals that he was closely involved with was a Scientologist.
Hmm.
Manson claims that he received Scientology training and that he was a clear, which means he had gone through all the major training to become a Scientologist. Being clear means that he was clear of all of his psychoses and neuroses and everything else that had tied him to his former life. Manson claimed to have been a clear, which is very interesting. But there was also talk that Manson had been involved with a strange religious organization called the Process Church of the Final Judgment.
Right. We discussed that with author William Kennedy and its connections to, you know, DeGrimson, his connections to Scientology back in England.
Well, there you go. So you've got all of that background then done already. Process itself, of course, was an offshoot of Scientology. So there seems to have been a kind of consistency there as well in Manson's background. As we know, Process members visited Manson in jail after he was arrested for the Sharon Tate killings. And we don't know what was discussed. But from that point on, Manson stopped talking about the Process. I was fascinated by the Process because members of the Process seemed to crop up again a few years later in New York City during the time I was living there, connected with the Son of Sam case. And the Son of Sam case was a string of murders of individuals in New York City by a person or persons wielding a .44 caliber bulldog revolver. It was believed that this was the work of several people until a man called David Berkowitz was arrested and claimed sole responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Berkowitz has since converted to Christianity and has come out and said that he did kill some of the people, but he did not kill all of them. And he lays the blame at the door of the Process.
Mm.
So we have the existence of a cult of killers to which both Charles Manson and David Berkowitz belonged, if we are to believe the documentation and the investigative journalism that's come down to us in the last 10 or 15 years or so. So we're looking at maybe not the Process Church of the Final Judgment per se, but a group within that church or a group of various members of that organization who have come out and become involved in everything from, drug dealing, child prostitution, human trafficking, and murder. So there was a period in the United States when we went through what we call the Satanic Cult Survivor Scare, prompted by a program aired on Geraldo Rivera's program, in which they talked about a Satanic Underground. It may have done a bit of disservice to the journalism that we were trying to do and the research that we were trying to do because it made this look so pervasive that people thought either this has got to be the figment of someone's imagination or on the other side that, you know, everything is satanic and we're all in deep trouble. I think the truth lies somewhere in between. There definitely have been cults involved in murder. We have documentation on this very clearly. The Matamoros case in Mexico at the border of Brownsville, Texas,
right,
was a cult of Central American witchcraft, we might say, that was involved in murder and in ritual murder. We know these things do exist. And we're somehow ready to believe that these things exist overseas and in foreign countries, but they don't exist in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we're ready to believe in political assassination in foreign countries, in almost any foreign country, mm-hmm, you know, but not in the United States. It's funny how we have this kind of blindsidedness when it comes to our country, but political assassinations do take place, political conspiracies do take place all over the world. Why not here as well? You know, why suddenly is it impossible for it to happen in the United States? It's the old, it can't happen here.
Boy, howdy.
Syndrome, yeah. But it does take place. And the Kennedy assassination was a focus of mine for a short time as well. Because of Bobby Kennedy, because of the involvement of a possible mind control subject like Sirhan Sirhan, someone who betrayed all of the symptoms of having been hypnotized at some point in his life and made to take the fall for the assassination. And I started pulling at that thread, and it led me back to the Kennedy assassination and some fascinating individuals who were involved with that. That really strains belief. You know, we get linked to the UFO phenomenon with the Kennedy assassination. Who would believe that? You know, who would think that there would be any connection between
these
two events?
That's right. Don't you connect Guy Bannister with one of the UFO with Ken Arnold?
That's right. Guy Bannister, for those of you who again, are not as old as I am, Guy Bannister was a former FBI agent who was in charge of a private detective agency in New Orleans when Lee Harvey Oswald was living in New Orleans. And out of Guy Bannister's office were very colorful individuals like David Ferry and Jack Martin. Mm-hmm. If you saw the movie JFK, the Oliver Stone film, you'd remember that David Ferry was played by Joe Pesci, mm-hmm. and Jack Martin was played by Jack Lemmon. Ed Asner was Guy Bannister. So that brings back the individuals in question. Bannister, when he was an FBI agent back in the 1940s, the late 1940s in the Pacific Northwest, he was the guy reporting on the UFO phenomenon, the Maury Island crash, one of the first sightings, the Kenneth Arnold sighting of the flying saucers. Guy Bannister was writing back to J. Edgar Hoover reporting on all of this. He was investigating the UFO sightings, and his air tells, the telegrams that he sent to Hoover still exist. They're available to be seen, to be read. There's Bannister himself reporting on interviews he was conducting with people who claimed they had seen UFOs in 1947. And then we have him suddenly, you know, not suddenly, but years later in New Orleans, peripherally involved, or maybe centrally involved, in the Kennedy assassination. But he wasn't the only one. Then we have a guy called Fred Crisman. Fred Crisman was this strange guy who lived up in the Pacific Northwest, who was involved in the very first UFO sighting at Maury Island, in which he and a friend of his were out fishing or something, and then a UFO exploded above them, rained down debris, it killed a dog, it wounded some of them. They kept pieces of this crashed UFO. They contacted the U.S. Air Force, which was the Army Air Force in those days. A couple of officers came to visit Fred Crisman, got samples of the UFO, got back in their plane, and their plane crashed. It was these two officers were killed. We don't know what Fred Crisman...
Yeah.
And we don't know what Crisman gave them, but there was Fred Crisman, and Crisman, turns out he had a murky background. Documentation on him is very hard to come by. He claimed he was an intelligence agent in the OSS during the war, which may or may not have been true. He claimed, or people claimed about him, that he was a CIA agent involved in disinformation, which may or may not have been true. Whatever the case, there's Fred Crisman in 1947, and then suddenly back in 1967, District Attorney Jim Garrison of New Orleans is calling Fred Crisman as a witness in the Kennedy assassination investigation. So now we have two individuals who were involved with UFO sightings in 1947, Guy Bannister and Fred Crisman, both being investigated by Jim Garrison because of their possible involvement in the Kennedy assassination. What was interesting about Crisman is that Crisman was also a bishop with the Universal Life Church. Now, Universal Life Church back in the 60s was something that almost anybody belonged to. You sent in $5 and you got a certificate, mm-hmm. you were a minister. But Crisman took a very serious approach to it, and he was a bishop, and he got other people involved in the church who also worked out of Guy Bannister's office. And that became very bizarre. What was Fred Crisman doing hanging out with Guy Bannister's people? You know, and this is one of the things that really bothered Jim Garrison. He couldn't figure out what the relationship was. What were all these churches doing around the Kennedy assassination? And that's something that I was fascinated with because I knew some of these churches back in 1967, 68, 69, and into the early 70s in New York City. And I started tying the names together, and I realized that, you know, as a teenager, I was in the midst of this conspiracy that was taking place between strange religious organizations, quasi-religious organizations, acting as fronts for intelligence activity and involvement in things like the assassinations, involved in the Biafran Civil War, and all the way up until the present day, involved in military activities in Bosnia, for instance. We find these same churches cropping up again and again and again, people who claim all sorts of religious titles, and who have virtually no congregation. There's nobody actually attending these churches as attending services of any kind. And yet they wear religious robes and a lot of religious jewelry and have elaborate titles, and they're acting as intelligence agency fronts. And we have that connection going back to the Kennedy assassination and beyond. connected back to the FBI in one particular case that I researched and I talk about in the book. So suddenly we're back to religion again. And David Ferry was one of these. David Ferry was a bishop with one of these churches. Jack
well, wasn't
Martin
he always
was
raised
a bishop.
As a Jesuit? Wasn't he tried to be a Jesuit, Ferry?
Yes, Ferry had a genuine, possibly a genuine religious vocation. He did attend seminary, but he did not last very long in seminary, which might have been due to his homosexuality, which is what has been talked about, mm-hmm. or it might have been other reasons, I don't know. But he didn't last in seminary, but he was always attracted to the religious life. And he became deeply involved with people that I've interviewed who've talked to me about Ferry. And he became deeply involved in a strange renegade branch of Eastern Orthodox Christianity, which was called the American Orthodox Catholic Church. And this goes back to around the time of the Kennedy assassination. There were bishops running around forming religious groups, again, with virtually no congregations. But a number of bishops got together and formed these churches. And the American Orthodox Catholic Church in New York was a front for the FBI. I have documentation showing that bishops who were involved with J. Edgar Hoover were involved with this church, and they were involved in setting it up. And I witnessed people coming in and out of that church who were on political missions and had nothing to do with religion. So I'm thinking these are a lot of very strange threads. You know, we're looking at... We go from Charles Manson and Sirhan Sirhan and David Berkowitz, and then we find ourselves with the Kennedy assassination and churches. So we have all these individuals connected with churches, and that was a disturbing idea to me. I had researched in Unholy Alliance about the involvement, for instance, of the Catholic Church and its involvement, or the involvement of many of its members and its high-ranking clergy in the emigration of Nazi war criminals to North and South America. People like Mengele, Josef Mengele, the angel of death at Auschwitz, mm-hmm. a lot of other high-ranking SS officers who have been helped in their escape to North and South America by the Catholic Church. So that already I had researched and documented, to at least to my satisfaction, that this sort of thing was taking place. So I said to myself, well, let's take a deeper look and see what these strange churches are doing. This is not the Catholic Church per se, but different little renegade branches of the Orthodox and Catholic churches that were involved in all sorts of intelligence activities. And that eventually led me back to, in another direction, to a group that had very serious connections to all of this activity, and that was a group that I called the Nine. The Nine was an organization, an informal grouping of some of the most powerful, wealthiest families in America, who in the early 1950s, at the time of the Korean War, were actually getting together in the woods of Maine in New England to hold seances where they were contacting extraterrestrial or supernatural beings. Back in the early 1950s, in the woods in Maine, a group of nine people gathered together to hold a series of seances, to contact a group of nine possibly extraterrestrial, possibly supernatural beings. Now, I don't know if it's as common practice to use seances to contact aliens, but that's sort of what was taking place in Maine in those days, in the early years of the Korean War and the Cold War. The seance was composed of some of the most powerful families in America, the old money families, the Astors, the DuPonts, the Forbes. These people were involved in the seance, in the series of seances. Now, you may think that's incredible and that I'm making it up, but if you have recourse to Sinister Forces or any of the other literature available, you're going to see that this is very well documented.
No, it sounds similar to Bohemian Grove, which takes place over in California.
Excuse me?
It sounds similar to what happens at Bohemian Grove every summer in California.
Well, Bohemian Grove is a big jamboree of these guys, you know. It's sort of a big get-together. What was happening in Maine was very secretive, height of the Cold War. Korea was just starting to happen. A lot of things were going on in our military and in our intelligence agencies. And the person running this group called the Nine was a man known as Andrea Puharich. Now, Puharich will be familiar to some of us as the man who supposedly discovered Uri Geller, the Israeli psychic who could bend spoons with his mind.
That's right. That's why the name is familiar. Yeah.
Well, Puharich brought not only Geller to the United States, he brought Peter Hurkos, another psychic, the Dutch psychic, who was involved in investigations on the Boston Strangler affair and all of that. Puharich was heavily involved with psychic research, but he was a medical doctor. And later he was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. He worked out at a Camp Dietrich or Fort Dietrich in Maryland in the Chemical Biological Warfare section. And he was the guy running these seances in Maine. His involvement in the military was promoting the use of paranormal abilities for military applications. So his seances may not have been totally benign. But at any rate, the people attending the seance included Arthur Young, the inventor of the Bell helicopter, his wife, Ruth Forbes Payne Young, of course, a member of the Forbes dynasty, of which John Kerry also was a member. We have one of the DuPonts and an Astor. So we have Astor, DuPont, Forbes, and Payne. We have a lot of very heavy hitters at this seance. The other people involved were friends of Puharich who were involved in his researches. Now, okay, here are the seances. They're contacting these extraterrestrial beings. The extraterrestrial beings are telling this group of nine people that they're going to be the nine Brahmins, the nine initiates who are going to help lead America and lead the world into a new age. To realize the power and to materialize the power of the nine in the universe, or in at least in the world, in North America, if nothing else. And that might have been the end of the story, except that a few years later, we find Arthur Young, the inventor, as I say, of the Bell helicopter. He's retired from working on helicopters, and he's founded a number of organizations devoted to mystical research and paranormal research. Wow, because we're going to go from Arthur Young to a woman known as Ruth Payne. Now, Ruth Payne was married to Michael Payne. Michael and Ruth Payne lived in Texas. Michael and Ruth Payne, or at least Ruth Payne, had as house guests for a number of months Lee Harvey Oswald and his wife, Marina Oswald.
Oh, my goodness.
Really?
Yeah. Ruth Payne was the daughter-in-law of Arthur Young and his wife, Ruth Forbes Payne Young. Michael Payne was the son of Ruth Forbes Payne Young. I have to put all the names in there so you won't confuse her with Ruth Payne of Texas. Ruth Payne was married to Michael Payne. Michael Payne was also involved with Bell Helicopter. He was working for Bell Aerospace at the time of the Kennedy assassination in Texas. Ruth Payne was not otherwise employed, but she had Marina Oswald and the children staying with her. A few months before the assassination, in September, August and September, Ruth Payne traveled from Texas to Philadelphia to visit Arthur Young and his wife, Ruth Forbes. So she was up there only 2 months before the assassination, at the time when she knew Lee and Marina Oswald, when Marina Oswald was staying with her. Here is a connection directly from the nine to the Kennedy assassination. What was she talking about to Arthur Young and Ruth Forbes? She must have mentioned the fact that she had these Russian people staying with her. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't Russian, but Marina Oswald was. She must have mentioned all of this. In fact, in her Warren Commission testimony, she refers to the fact that at one point, Lee Oswald was considering going to Philadelphia. This never gets followed up. But the obvious assumption is that Lee Oswald would have been going to talk to Arthur Young, one of the pioneers of the American military-industrial complex, one of the original nine, somebody very much involved in paranormal research. What would Lee Harvey Oswald be doing talking to Arthur Young? I would have loved to have seen that. But then I started looking at the Warren testimony, which anyone can do, and I urge people to take a look at Ruth Payne's testimony, because something interesting takes place. One of the Warren Commission members is Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA. He's now part of the Warren Commission investigating the Kennedy assassination. He's there for some of Ruth Payne's testimony. For other parts, he's absent. But every time Ruth Payne gets into an area that might be very interesting, Alan Dulles changes the subject and moves it off center. So we never really find out some vital piece of information. And I wondered about that. And I started to research Alan Dulles a little bit, and I found out that Alan Dulles had a mistress, Mary Bancroft. And Mary Bancroft was a close personal friend of Ruth Forbes Payne Young. They were like sisters. They went traveling to Europe together and did all of that. Huh. So we have a connection between Alan Dulles, Mary Bancroft, his mistress, to Ruth Forbes Payne Young and Arthur Young. It is conceivable that he did not want this whole connection to be revealed, and he kept moving Ruth Payne off center every time she got close to something that might have been interesting in the testimony. And you can't help but wonder, did Alan Dulles realize the connection between his own mistress and possibly, you know, the Oswalds? I mean, it's a fascinating little tight nexus that really defies belief that all of these people knew each other before the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not the end of the story, however, because we know, for instance, that a guy called George de Morenschild, a Russian nobleman, an oil man, and a CIA informant, was the man who introduced Lee Harvey Oswald to Ruth Payne in Texas. Well, I didn't know until only a few months ago when a professor at one of the universities here in the Midwest contacted me and said, did you know that George de Morenschild was also involved with the Nine? And he gave me documents that show that going back to around late 1950s and 1960, he was involved with one of the people connected with the Nine. So we have basically one member of the Nine handing off Lee Harvey Oswald to another member of the Nine.
Oh, okay.
Now, George de Morenschild goes back to our original discussion of a couple of days ago in which we're talking about the churches. George de Morenschild, of course, was involved with the Russian Orthodox Church, a specific branch of it that was heavily involved in anti-communist intrigues in the United States. So we have the Russian Orthodox Church in Texas. We have the American Orthodox Catholic Church in New Orleans. We have all these Orthodox churches swirling around Lee Oswald on the one side. And then we have the Nine with all of their paranormal connections swirling around him on the other side. Lee Oswald didn't have a chance, you know. He was surrounded by a lot of religious or fringe religious and occult connections. So whether we believe that he was manipulated directly by the Nine or not, we know that these sinister forces were around Oswald, that he really was only a handshake or two away from the Nine itself. That the people he was staying with, or the people his wife was staying with, Ruth Payne, was related to the original Nine by marriage. Alan Dulles, his mistress, was a friend of Ruth Forbes Young. This was just too incestuous a little connection to be ignored, and yet it has been ignored. This is a fascinating aspect of American history, and one that bears closer investigation. But no one's done it. No one's looking at this and thinking what really was going on there.
So the activities that took place by the Nine back in the 50s and 60s, has that continued today?
Well, the Nine still exist in the sense that there are still people in the United States who claim that they're in contact with the spiritual entities of the Nine. Most of the original members have passed. Puharich died a few years ago. Arthur Young is gone. Ruth Forbes Payne has passed away. Ruth Payne herself is still alive. And I think most of the others who were involved with Puharich have all passed away. Puharich was steadily involved in intelligence work and the paranormal throughout his entire life. Uri Geller believed that Puharich was his CIA handler. I mean, he said as much in his own writings. So it's believed that Puharich was basically the CIA man for conducting research into the paranormal. And he continued that until his death some time ago. But there are people now who claim that they're still in contact with the Nine telepathically or through seances or through some spiritual means. And these people were friends of Puharich. These people sort of picked up the torch. When Puharich dropped the torch, they picked it up. And they're maintaining the spiritual connection. Whether or not they're involved in political intrigues, I can't say. I have absolutely no knowledge of that. And I may doubt it, actually, at this remove. But that anything is possible, of course.
What kind of message had they been channeling from the Nine?
It's very ambiguous and very vague. You can read their original statement in Puharich's book on Uri Geller, which is called Uri. The appendix to that book has a statement. It's extremely vague. It's very New Agey and very, you know, world peace and all of that. But since then, there's been a number of texts that have come down that talk about, you know, the danger to the world if they don't straighten up their act and get their act together and all of this. But again, it's very vague and ambiguous. Nothing really comes out and says what they're really up to. They're not really very exciting in terms of scriptural texts, if you look at it from that way, or spiritual texts. They're just sort of a piece with a lot of New Age stuff. So I don't find it that stimulating. But what I find disturbing to me is the fact that they would have been involved in probably the most critical political event of the 20th century, which was the assassination of President Kennedy. This kind of thing disturbs me. Whether or not they were deliberately involved or not, it would seem that they were channeling forces that, had they been as powerful as they claimed, somebody would have known something about what was going on and perhaps stopped it. Or perhaps they had no desire to get involved with interfering with this assassination. On the other hand, maybe they looked forward to it. Maybe they were in favor of the assassination. I mean, all kinds of things occur to you. But in the absence of anyone telling you, in the absence of documentation, it's very hard to find out. But we have to let the facts speak for themselves. Oswald was surrounded by these people. Mm-hmm. He was surrounded by very strange individuals who had very strange religious and occult connections. And you have to ask yourself, this is an aspect of the assassination that hasn't been covered, and is it meaningful? What does it portend? And the crux of sinister forces is that these groups continue to function up until the present day. The American Orthodox Catholic Church, the David Ferry, Jack Martin operation still exists and is still involved with political skullduggery around the world. There was even a man at Iran-Contra, during the Iran-Contra hearings, who claimed to be a Catholic priest who, as it turned out later, was a member of some strange renegade branch of the Orthodox Church. Again, you know, they raised their ugly heads. And this guy was involved in laundering money and running drugs and guns and everything else. I mean, he was a witness during Iran-Contra. And you have to ask yourself, what does this mean? You know, are these people really religious people who are involved in fringe organizations and who find intelligence activity is consistent with their religious beliefs? Are these simply intelligence agents who are masquerading as clergy for whatever reason? What's the point? You know, we're sometimes distracted by the secret society aspect and by the occult, by satanic groups, which are troublesome enough. But quite often the satanic groups don't have the direct involvement in the political life that these fringe so-called churches do. So it's a thing where you have to sit back and look and say, are they working hand in glove? Is one the outer court of an inner court of intelligence operations? We know about, for instance, involvement of Temple of Set leader Michael Aquino in intelligence activities in the U.S. Army. That's what he was doing in psychological warfare and all of that sort of thing. You know, what is it about the intelligence work that attracts occultists? Or what is it about occultism that attracts intelligence agents?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think you raised the key question there. Are these fringe groups really religious types that believe they're doing the work of whatever god they serve by engaging in these, shady operations? Or are they just costumes, disguises, if you will, for spies?
Mm-hmm.
Does it give them access to places they couldn't go if they were, you know, passing off as a secular, say, you know, international businessman, for example?
Sure.
I think that's the key question. And if they are serving some other god, who are they serving, and for what purpose?
Exactly, that's exactly my point in Sinister Forces. You know, I raise the question, if nothing else. I don't try to answer it in terms of this guy is working for this, you know, this particular operation, that he's a devil worshiper or something. I don't go quite that far, but I do lay out the documentation and I say, well, figure it out for yourselves. You know,
mm-hmm.
In the case of the American Orthodox Catholic Church, it was created, the New York City branch was created by a man who was a Ukrainian Orthodox priest. I mean, his father had been a priest. He was ordained by a famous Ukrainian bishop. I mean, these were people who were very, very religious. At the same time, very anti-communist. Anti-communist to the point that they really boarded over to the pro-Nazi side, figuring the Nazis were better than the communists. And you have to ask yourself, well, wait a minute, hold on, you know. Can you be a devout clergyman? Can you be, in this case, a Ukrainian Orthodox bishop of an ancient Christian tradition, and at the same time be so rabidly anti-communist that you will condone the worst excesses of the intelligence agencies abroad? You will act as a front for all sorts of activities, including perhaps assassinations. I mean, is this okay if you're a bishop in a Christian church? You know, you have to ask yourself these questions. I mean, you have to, these are tough questions to answer. I realize that there are no easy answers.
No.
But now we have an administration that feels it's been anointed. You know, are we in danger of creating a kind of theocracy built around one perception of what it means to be Christian?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is an important question for all of us.
Absolutely. Oh, as we just have a couple minutes left, Peter, how do you perceive the sinister forces that are aligned against us?
Well, rather than answering that directly, let me look at it from this point of view. The sinister forces are the dark side of the American experience. It's the side that we've been repressing in ourselves. Everything from the horrible things we did to the Native American population from the very beginning, and continue to do in many parts of North and South America, to the abandonment of our own American ideals during World War II, after World War II, and the Cold War particularly, when we thought that to fight the communists we would have to make common cause with the Nazis. When we did that, I think we started to lose our soul at the end of World War II, when we thought it was okay to bring the Nazis in and to use some of the people who have been responsible for some of the worst human slavery in Europe and some of the worst mass murder, and to use them, you know, to work with us against the communists. We started to barter our soul then. And people like Eleanor Roosevelt and Albert Einstein and people like that went on the record and saying, you can't do this. Even President Truman forbade the importation of additional Nazis after he found out what was going on, and they ignored him. Basically, the military ignored the president and continued to do that. That was the beginning, I think, of when we started to lose our soul, when we started to feel the end justified the means. At that point, we went in the wrong direction, I think. And then it continued with the MKUltra brainwashing experimentation and interfering with the human mind and hypnosis, drugs, all sorts of attempts to manipulate an individual's human mind and then extrapolate that to manipulate the minds of an entire population. I think at that point we became extremely cynical about what was spiritually good or spiritually evil. We began to think only in terms of pragmatism, of the human mind and the human soul as a kind of tool or even as a weapon. When we got to that point, I think we lost our bearing, and we have to recapture that bearing. We have to get back and find our moral compass as a country.
Mm-hmm. Boy, you know, you said it so well, and using the human mind as a tool, I think, is what we're seeing happen more and more. And it's an expendable tool.
Mm-hmm. And I would say even a step further that the MKUltra process or experiments and were designed not just to manipulate and shape the human mind, but also the human soul.
Mm-hmm.
For purposes,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be wielded as military weapons.
So when is book 3 going to come out?
It will be out in June.
Oh, well, we'll have to have you back before then so you can tell us all about it. How
That'll
can
be my
people
pleasure.
Get the first two books?
They can get it through Amazon.com, of course. They can get it through directly by contacting Trine Day Publishing. The phone number there is an 800 number, is 1-800-556-2012. You can call them directly and have it delivered to you.
We highly recommend it. I mean, this is thoroughly researched, well-documented, and as Peter pointed out, he basically lays out the evidence and lets you then pull on the threads to follow the research mm-hmm. where it leads. And it is broad in scope. It covers everything going back to the well, to the Adena culture,
yeah,
and right up through the present day. Peter, this is really a remarkable work, and we're very happy to have this as part of our library here for research and reference.
Well, thank you very much, and like I say, it's a pleasure being on, and I hope you have me on again soon.
Thank you. We would love that. Of course, we're going to be talking with you again this Saturday.
Yes,
that's right.
You're going to be on RBN Live with us, so those people who have been listening to these broadcasts, hope you've been taking notes because you want to be able to call in the second hour and ask Peter your questions directly.
Yes, ask the author. Peter Lavenda, author of Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft, a three-book set. Thank you for being our guest on PID Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.
Peter Lavenda's website is sinisterforces.info. Our website, with the show notes and links to everywhere you can find us on the web, is pidradio.com. Our email address for your comments and questions, radio@peeringintodarkness.com. This weekend on A View from the Bunker, an interview with Dr. Michael Heiser about the Divine Council. Don't miss it. Until then, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here. Don't let the hard times get you down. Older days will disappear. There's a new day coming. A new and living in the past. God can do a new thing now in a kingdom that will last. He'll make a way across your wilderness like a river frozen in desert land. There's a new day coming, a new
analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.